Now, as you start thinking about your persuasion IQ, let's talk about some of the changes out there in the world of persuasion. Where's that persuasion resistance coming from? Well, usually it's those old, tired persuasion techniques that you keep using that have cost you hundreds of thousands, probably millions of dollars, by using the wrong, old-styled, overused technique. The skilled persuader is absolutely priceless to any company. A company that invests in the development of its employees' persuasion skills will ultimately see a greater influx of new clients, a greater retention of both new and current clients, and increased business transactions with those clients. Now, in other words, the investment to hone and polish people skills and persuasion tools result in a whole organization upgrade, basically gas to that vehicle. Perhaps most importantly, this transformation includes a significant upgrade of the bottom line. It's simple to understand. Effective persuasion is the heartbeat of a business's success. The worst time to learn a persuasion skill is when you need it. Let me repeat that. The worst time to learn a persuasion skill is when you need it. Persuasion must be mastered before it's needed, or the opportunity is lost forever. Now, how can I make such bold claims? Does persuasion really affect the bottom line that much? Now, consider the following examples. Persuaders are always on the front lines. They are usually the first contact a prospective client has with the entire company organization. Effective persuasion draws interest, builds rapport, and seals deals. Now, what about internally? Effective persuasion increases motivation, enhances loyalty, and boosts morale. When employees are happy, they give their best and the company prospers. All around, persuaders are the gas for the engine of success in business. They get people in the door. By staying focused on this front line, they make work and growth opportunities possible for a myriad of other people who continue to work with new clients long after initial contact. Persuaders are what keep a business's doors open. Without them, there is no business. Because persuaders are the heartbeat of an organization, are vital to its success, it is important to help strengthen both individuals and entire companies. In all the years that I have worked in persuasion, sales, influence, and leadership, I have never yet found a perfect persuader. I've met very skilled persuaders, but none that have completely mastered all that they were capable of. It's an understandable predicament. It's demanding enough just to keep up with the bills, maintain existing customers, lead the organization, prospect for new clients, outmaneuver the competition, and increase product knowledge. Faced with so many tasks, it's difficult to find the time to spend on developing yet another skill. Ironically, this area of persuasion that is so easily overlooked is the very one that would make everything else fall into place. Now let's return to the adage that dull knives work the hardest. That pretty much hits the nail on the head. Working hard is not the same as working smart. Are your knives sharp? Are you working smart? If you sharpened up in this one area, you'd likely be working more efficiently overall. Check yourself. Are you just going through the motions? Are you still using the same old tools over and over again without seeing the desired results? Or worse, are you making the same old mistakes over and over again? Are you making less than you could because of the common old school persuasion blunders? My research shows that there are 10 common blunders that will limit your persuasion success and limit your income. There are things you're doing right now that cause people to resist you and your message. Each blunder is like driving around town with your emergency brake on. Do you see the picture? You are wondering why your car never has much power. These blunders are simple to fix, but expensive to have. Obstacle number one, the Lake Wobegon effect. There's an African proverb that says, a hyena cannot smell its own stench. Radio humorist Garrison Keillor coined the term Lake Wobegon effect to describe the tendency most people have to see themselves as better than average. In his book, Lake Wobegon Days, Keillor depicts a town where the women are strong, the men are all good-looking, and all the children are above average. Like the Lake Wobegon folks, we all have a natural bias to see ourselves as above average. It's really hard to admit when we just don't cut it, especially when it comes to skills that we regard as basic or common. Psychologists call this tendency cognitive bias or the better-than-average effect. When I teach persuasion, negotiation, or mastery seminars, I ask my students to list the top 10 reasons they are not more successful. I am always amazed on how many people do not put their own names on their papers. They find plenty of reasons for their lack of success, but we all know the number one reason is themselves. That notion, however, never makes it on their radar screen. We always feel we must gloss over our weaknesses to make things seem better than they actually are. We lie about our incomes, our ages, and our weights. Did you know that when reporting income level, most people fudge the figures by at least 25%? Why is this Lake Wobegon effect such a stumbling block in persuasion? The reason the Lake Wobegon effect has such a negative impact, not only on our persuasive abilities, but also in our lives, is because we are lying to ourselves. That's the bottom line. We are lying to others, and we're lying to ourselves. We are investing in hopes and dreams that are not based on honest evaluation. It might seem nice to view the world through rose-colored glasses for a while, but in the end, you're setting yourself up for failure. The Lake Wobegon effect ultimately gives us a false sense of security. When afflicted by it, we become numb to reality and fail to see exactly where we stand and what we need to improve. This tendency can lower our expectations about ourselves and falsely improve our confidence. Studies show that one of the reasons people embellish and exaggerate their abilities and skills is their psychological need to boost their own self-esteem. I call this hypothermic complacency. It's just like the medical condition. You slowly freeze to death without ever even realizing it. You feel a little cold in the beginning, but you say to yourself, oh, come on, it's not that cold, I feel fine. You go on telling yourself this, and then it's not long before your past feeling, in both senses of the word. Your past feeling the cold in the literal, physical sense, because your senses have numbed in the freezing temperatures. And your past feeling in the psychological sense, because you have convinced yourself that everything's great. So it is with the Lake Wobegon effect. I'm not recommending a doom and gloom attitude, but how can you expect to set goals, both modest and lofty, if they are built on false skills and presumptions? Better to take a good hard look at yourself, come to grips with the facts, both the good and the bad. Only then will you make real progress. The Lake Wobegon effect isn't only present in personal psychological context. It can also be found in most people in the following areas: income, trust levels, people skills, sales ability, driving ability, investing, fairness, weight, and integrity. The Lake Wobegon effect manifests when we are evaluating a skill or talent that we expect ourselves to have, or when others expect us to have a particular skill. When social pressure or social validation is involved, we make higher than expected evaluations. For example, if you were in sales and you were asked to rate your ability to connect with people or your product knowledge, you would be 90% likely to rate yourself above average. Even though, mathematically, the validity of your assertion would be less than 50%. Among managers, 90% will rate themselves better than the average manager. At the high school level, 70% of students rate themselves above average in leadership. We tend to overestimate everything from grades and physical appearance to the possibility of divorce. To drive home the Lake Wobegon effect's prevalence, one study found that most people believe they are more athletic, intelligent, organized, ethical, logical, interesting, fair-minded, and attractive than the average person. Things change, however, when people start evaluating themselves with respect to skills that are not part of their everyday world. Individuals tend to rate themselves below average in such areas as acting, mechanics, juggling, nuclear fusion, or computer programming. Things our employer or society does not expect us to know and understand. This Lake Wobegon effect also operates in relation to death, disease, and natural disasters. We think we're immune. It's going to happen to somebody else. Most people feel they will live longer than the average person. The average age for death is 75. But when polled, most individuals guess they would live to be 84 years old. Now, it's interesting to see persuasion students. They say they have mastered people skills and empathy, persistence, communication and listening, personal mastery and closing skills, but they haven't. They say they have. We talked to their prospects, and they say they haven't. So, what is your personal Lake Wobegon effect? What is it that you've been telling yourself and everyone else you do really well, when in fact you don't do it well at all, or at least not above average? What is it that you've been telling yourself and everyone else you do really well, when in fact you don't do it well at all? Now, I know you've been trying to convince yourself and convince other people that you do it really well, but let's take an honest look. What is your Lake Wobegon effect? Blunder number two, the persuasion pitfall, the brick wall of persuasion. I know the persuasion pitfall has happened to you. You enter a retail store and you're approached by a sharply dressed persuader. You're interested in buying, but the representative is a little aggressive. You get an alarming feeling in the pit of your stomach, and then you do what many of your customers do. You lie. You say, "Oh, I'm just looking. I'll come back later. It's too expensive. I have to talk to my spouse before I decide." What you're really thinking is, "I don't like this guy. I don't trust her," or something didn't feel quite right. In the end, you never go back to the store, you never recommend the store, and neither the store owner nor the persuader ever knows why. This is the persuasion pitfall. This pitfall is a silent killer. 97% of the people in the world will never say anything to alert you to the fact they're feeling this way. They are more comfortable lying to you, so they don't hurt your feelings. They walk away and simply never deal with you again. The reason this pitfall is a killer is because so often we don't even realize we're doing it. We're offending people and don't even know it. We think we're just being friendly or enthusiastic. Careful, because even though friendliness and enthusiasm are great attributes, if there is even so much as a hint of force, deception, hype, or sales underlying any of it, you've pretty much sunk the deal. Audiences are tough. Ever smarter consumers have a lot of resistance to the old style of persuading. And many people have a brick wall of resistance up before you've even started your presentation. They assume you're going to be the old, greasy, manipulative salesperson before you've even had a chance to speak. They are all ready to resist you before you start. Is this fair? It doesn't matter. It's reality. So what do you do to overcome this tendency? Your persuasion attempts must be non-threatening and very natural. Forget loud and flashy. That strategy only encourages resistance. And most definitely, forget about high pressure. Not only does that solidify the wall of resistance in a particular moment, but the wall will increase in size. When people feel that they have been pressured, bullied, or coerced into buying or doing something they don't need or want, they are resentful. They will never do business with you again. They will detest you for tricking or manipulating or forcing them to do what they didn't want to do. They will badmouth you to all their family and friends, even to people they don't know. In the end, you end up losing not only this one person, but as the grapevine goes, potentially hundreds of others as well. The moment people sense that you are attempting to persuade them, the brick wall increases in size and strength. To counter this tendency, persuasion and sales must take place below the conscious radar. The moment they sense you're trying to persuade them to do something, they will resist you. See if you can cultivate a sixth sense. When it comes to the push and pull aspect of persuasion, you must encourage without pushing. Entice, but don't ensnare. You have to sense and then predict based upon knowledge, instinct, experience, and nonverbal cues what you can do and how your audience will respond. With this sensitivity and knowledge, which you can learn, there won't be any smacking headfirst into the brick wall of resistance. There are common mistakes that will create large bricks in the walls of resistance. When you cover every single possible detail, your audience feels overwhelmed, confused, and stressed out. When you're always asking unnecessary questions, your audience feels antagonized and annoyed. When you say words like, "Well, honestly," they're thinking, "What, you weren't honest before? Are they getting ready to lie?" Or you take too much time with a person, they're thinking, "Well, you don't respect their time." Or you demean or belittle the competition, they're thinking that you lack confidence. Or when you exaggerate the details, your audience feels mistrustful and resentful. When you try to show off your impeccable skills, your know-how, and your experience, your audience feels mistrustful and that you're arrogant, egotistical, and condescending. When you say, "Are you prepared to buy today?" and they're thinking, "Oh, incoming. Here come the old style tactics." Or you're over friendly or happy, they feel that you're insincere and fake. When you say, how are you doing today? They're thinking, now what are you trying to sell me? Or when you employ those coercive old style tactics, they feel manipulated and turned off. Obstacle number 3, commission versus employee. As Nikki Giovanni said, if you don't understand yourself, you don't understand anybody else. Most people think of themselves as employees. We make an hourly wage or annual salary. We get our fixed amount. The truth of the matter is, this is not entirely the case. We, all of us, are really on commission or paid for our performance. Whether we realize it or not, whether we like it or not, this is reality. Now, what do I really mean by this? The path to success is often blocked by our inability to take full responsibility for our current situation. We really are paid exactly what we're worth. Hold on here. Or what others feel we are worth. Remember, I'm not here to sugarcoat this. If we don't like our mediocre incomes, but do nothing about it, we are just getting exactly what we've asked for. If we'd stop complaining and begin proactively seeking to enhance our knowledge, skills, and talents, we'd see an increase in opportunity and income. It is in this sense that we are all on full commission. We get out of life what we put into it. We are rewarded precisely by our skills, talents, and traits. Consider your current situation and ask yourself, am I happy? Am I doing all that I can? Is there more out there? When we are honest with ourselves, we often find that the status quo is set where it is because we are either comfortable or lazy, not because we honestly believe it's ideal. If you know you've reached a plateau and you're ready to break through, it's time to step up to the plate and take on the new do-it-yourself project. Do you know what that project is? It's you. Roll up your sleeves, because you and you alone will decide what your income will be. What are you really worth? And does that match your current paycheck? I think the whole world should be paid on commission. You decide based on your skills, mindset, and talents how much you're going to get paid. It is interesting to watch more and more college graduates see the potential of being in the field of persuasion, owning their own business, working on commission, wanting incentives or bonuses based on performance. All these desires usually mean an increase in income. What we are finding is that after the second or third year, most commission-based persuasion professionals are making more than those who started with a straight salary. The average college graduate started around $42,000. The average sales professional salary was over $81,000, meaning they earn almost twice as much as a salaried employee. This increase in earnings is also true of entrepreneurs. The average income for families headed by a self-employed person was roughly double the average for a household headed by someone who is working for somebody else. It's time to treat yourself like you're on commission. It is time to earn what you're worth. Obstacle number 4. Hey, I'm a people person. I can converse with anyone. Being an extrovert, having the gift of gab, or being able to make small talk with anyone you meet can definitely be used to your advantage. But watch yourself. How can you persuade if you're always talking? It will be very annoying to your audience if they sense that you like to hear yourself talk more than listening to their concerns. Remember, it's about them, not you. Great persuaders listen more than they talk. In fact, great persuaders use their listening and questioning skills to get their audience to persuade themselves. Often when somebody comes to you, she already knows what she wants. She already has something in mind. She just needs to talk through it with someone. Which approach do you think will have a better, longer-term result? You persuading your audience or you helping them persuade themselves? It's much better if your audience feels as if they have made the decision themselves without perceived external influences. When you do have to talk, be succinct and to the point. A good rule of thumb is not to talk more than 30% of the time. Now, with these guidelines in place, it's worth pointing out you must always be prepared to adapt and adjust to the personality type of your audience. For some people, talking 30% of the time will still be too much. Discussing only what is relevant to the matter at hand and keeping chit-chat to a minimum is best for these no-nonsense types. Your attempts at being their buddy will likely annoy and maybe even offend. Some people feel that being overly warm and personable is not appropriate when you have just met someone for the very first time. Polite and professional, sure, but warm and fuzzy, no. The bottom line is, don't get too friendly too fast. Obstacle number 5. Vomiting too much information. Yes, I said vomiting. Many times when we are trying to be persuasive, we want to highlight all the perks and all the pluses. It's only natural. Wouldn't helping somebody see the potential gains of your product or service be a good thing? Well, sure, but here's the issue. Your audience will buy for their own reasons and only their reasons. They don't care why you like the product or service. They don't care how much you know about it. The more you spout off about features, the more your audience mentally checks out. When you want to draw attention to benefits of a product or service, the best thing to do is uncover the features or benefits your audience is looking for first. Why spend precious time and energy highlighting things they don't care about? Let them tell you what they're looking for, and then center your discussion around those few key points. It is critical to remember that most people already know what they want. In fact, your audience's mindset often is looking for reasons not to buy. It's a natural defense mechanism. They're thinking, how do I make sure I'm not getting myself into something I'll regret? What could go wrong? There's another way spouting and spewing too much information can backfire. You might actually feature something they're not interested in or something they even see as a drawback. Why give them reasons not to do it? Again, let them tell you what they're looking for. After you've discussed what they care about, after they've made the decision to buy, then and only then should you fill in the remaining blanks with other benefits or features. Don't over-persuade or oversell by cluttering or distracting the few most important key points. Over-persuading your audience is in the same category. When you over-persuade, you give your audience no room to ask questions or make a decision. You come across as forceful, aggressive, and obnoxious. Many times our impatience to impress our audience with our knowledge and wisdom leads to over-persuading. Do you really think you convince someone by interrupting them? Research demonstrates that 81% of persuaders talk more than necessary during the persuasion process. They are talking too much, and you are likely talking too much. Careful of the woebegone effect. When we talk too much and fail to allow our audience to ask questions, it increases the thickness of the brick wall of resistance. We have all heard the doctor analogy in persuasion, meaning you have to listen and ask questions before you can diagnose the problem. The doctor does not come into the examination room and try to sell you on a prescription without first asking questions or trying to discover what you really need. Like a physician, you need to step back and be able to absorb and evaluate everything your audience is saying. While monitoring persuaders, I have found a constant epidemic of over-persuasion and vomiting features and benefits. So, are you over-persuading? Are you vomiting too much information? Well, ask yourself these questions. Do you interrupt your audience in your eagerness to highlight another point before they've finished? Are you worried about making the sale or satisfying a new customer? Do you ever lose their eye contact or get a glazed look? Do they seem stressed, indifferent, or agitated? Does your audience seem overwhelmed or confused? Are you concentrating on what you need to say next instead of really listening? Is your audience giving you excuses and objections that you've already covered or you know that aren't really true? Are you talking about yourself instead of discovering their needs? If any of these ring true, it's a symptom of overpersuasion and vomiting features. Obstacle number 6, you're motivated by desperation. Does it feel good to be a wild animal's prey? How about when someone is stalking you and they don't exactly have your best interests in mind? Are you coming across as a ravenous wolf or a shark after the smell of blood? This is how your audience feels when they can sense you are desperate for their compliance. Research shows that people can sense when a persuader or salesperson is uneasy, nervous, or tense. In other words, if you're uncomfortable, they're uncomfortable. There's no way around it. They will see past your gleaming smile, and even if they don't understand it, they'll start to get the feeling that you're a wolf in sheep's clothing. How do you know if you're in desperation mode? You know the mentality. I have to get the sale or else. I have to change his mind or else. I have to get his business or it's over. I have to negotiate the deal today. There are no other options. Usually, desperation is rooted in fear. If you ever find yourself slipping into desperation mode, ask yourself, what are you so afraid of? What is the worst thing that can happen? Is it really that bad? What if the worst reality did happen? You've got to face your fears, but despair-driven persuasion rarely works. Even if you get your way, it'll hurt you in the long run. Your audience will not appreciate feeling that you pressured them. They will resent you, harbor negative feelings towards you, and never do business with you again. Desperation leads to poor decisions, forces unwanted choices, reduces options, and spawns regret. Obstacle number 7, the fear of rejection. Now, we just talked about how despair is rooted in fear. Now I want to talk about the fear of rejection because it's one of the most common fears of all. Of all the things we might fear, most of us will have a bout with this one. We all experience rejection in small doses every day. But what about those who persuade for a living? Rejection seems to take a higher toll. We avoid rejection like the plague, but it affects our paychecks. Rejection causes one or two things to happen. We either run away from the rejection, which solves nothing, or our fears overtake us and we become paralyzed, which also solves nothing. Ironically, whether we run or become paralyzed, neither option helps the situation. When we don't handle our fears appropriately, we inadvertently end up being the ones passing out the bricks for the wall of resistance. How excited would you be to buy from someone who seemed nervous, tense, and demanding? Or if they seemed overly eager for your approval? Even if his awkwardness were totally unrelated to the product, you would probably still feel uneasy buying from this particular person. Fear of rejection can also affect the bottom line by inhibiting you from getting out there and approaching people in the first place. If you are so incapacitated by fears of rejection that you retreat from attempting persuasion at all, then you have sealed your own fate. You know, we can hate and fear rejection all we want, but it's still going to happen. What do we do about it? What do great persuaders do about it? How do we respond so that our fear of rejection doesn't paralyze us and affect our performance? The first thing to keep in mind is that even if your audience ultimately concludes that your product or service is not the right fit, they are not rejecting you personally. We generally understand this concept on a superficial level, but I invite you to give it some thought and really let it sink in. Great persuaders think through the reality of the situation in a rational, unemotional way. This person just met me. She doesn't even know me. She knows nothing of my background, personal interests, hopes, or dreams. It is not me that she is rejecting. Once you have established this concept, then it naturally follows that your audience's rejection has no bearing on your worth or value. It is totally irrelevant to such matters. Do not allow yourself to feel inferior, embarrassed, or depressed. The ability to bounce back after being faced with rejection on any scale is critical in the persuasion world. Great persuaders have the ability to erase the negativity from their minds at will and move on with a clean slate in a matter of minutes. A study conducted by Harvard Business School found that highly successful persuaders do not take no personally. This tendency is worth noting considering the fact that most of us hang on to negativity and use it to nurse our wounds or make excuses for weeks and months and sometimes even years. Another way to hasten your rebound from rejection is to realize that your worst fears are probably not even realistic. Suppose you just didn't have it together and a sweet deal slipped through your fingers. No matter what you said or did, your client's words were final. In other words, you were rejected. Is your life really over? Does that person now hate your guts? Are they going to smear your good name and come after your family in a mad rage? Are they going to spray paint the office with slanderous, hurtful remarks? Of course not. The truth is, it just wasn't a good fit. You blew it. You're going to work on it. They have forgotten about it in a matter of minutes or hours. You should too. Obstacle number 8, the lack of preparation. Another reason our persuasion power weakens is that we get lazy and don't take the time to prepare. After acquiring a certain amount of experience, we take for granted that we're pretty smooth and that we can always wing it or go through the motions. Well, maybe you can get away with that mentality every now and then, but I'm here to tell you that it's a bad practice. If you catch yourself feeling this way, it's time to take a personal inventory. First of all, you're going to come across as unprofessional, too laid back, or too relaxed. These perceptions are all turnoffs, making your audience or potential client feel like the encounter is not important to you. If you're going to be persuasive, you have to do your homework. If you aren't up on the critical details, you risk coming across as uninformed. How can your audience take you seriously if you aren't taking them or the situation seriously? As we monitor great persuaders, there's four areas in which they prepare. They know their product and service inside and out. They know their audience and their needs and wants so they can customize their presentation. They have several tools in the toolbox of persuasion that they can use and present other options and alternatives. And they know how to read people and tailor their persuasive presentation. Obstacle number 9, prejudging and making assumptions about your audience. Have you ever caught yourself saying, "Oh, great, look at that strange person. He's never going to buy," or, "I can just tell she's not going to like what I'm offering," or, "I can't change their mind"? We do it all the time. We qualify our audience or clients based on only a thumbnail sketch of information, or worse, no information at all. The problem with this qualification is that we make up our minds before even attempting persuasion, and we end up losing deals, negotiations, or clients because we've already decided it wouldn't work. This is one of the most devastating mistakes you can make, because you really cannot judge a book by its cover. Many, many times we find that people who seem to be the least likely candidates are the ones who become a big part of your business. Your audience can sense when they don't really matter to you. If the ship wasn't sinking already, your lack of interest will definitely sink it fast. Give your audience the time and attention they deserve. Wouldn't it be a shame to lose a deal because you judged someone wrongly, only to learn later that he ended up going to your competition when you had exactly what he needed all along? Furthermore, even if it turns out that what you have to offer is not right for him, he still very well may know someone who does need it. If you're treating him right, he may send you countless referrals. Whether you are consistently successful or not, every time you interact with someone, you are gaining invaluable experience in honing your skills, and that starts to create a great persuader. Obstacle number 10, closing skills, the magic cure-all. Dale Carnegie says, there's only one way to get anybody to do anything, and that's by making the other person want to do it. Your audience is tired of those old phrases. You know the ones. Tired sales phrases like, "Well, the truth is, trust me on this one, nobody cares as much as I do. Oh, off the record, I'll treat you right. Oh, call me anytime. Everybody uses it. That looks perfect on you. I'm looking out for you. I'm your friend. I think there's one left. This is a perfect fit." Closing skills were a big thing 20 years ago. You had to learn to be a closer. You were taught that closing skills were all you needed. If you did not persuade enough people, you had to learn more closing skills. Nowadays, sure, it's nice to have a few closing skills in your persuasion toolbox, but shouldn't you spend more time opening up your audience before you think about closing a deal with them? In fact, great persuaders don't even have to use closing techniques. That's because their audience is ready to purchase before the end of the conversation has ever been reached. You need to be able to connect with your audience, be sincere and empathetic, and show them you have their best interest in mind. When dealing with a potential client, you should spend more time on connecting, building rapport, and uncovering needs and wants than gunning for a close. Persuading your audience on a product or service or idea occurs throughout the entire persuasive process, not just at the very end. In fact, studies show that how you open your presentation is much more important than how you close it. Research also shows that hard closes not only offend, but over time they have lost their effectiveness. In reality, hard closes work less than 3 to 5% of the time, and those that do work, over half the persuaded audience later has buyer's remorse, with many wanting to return the product they felt pressured to buy. Remember, closing skills like trying to get a kiss after a bad date. There are other things that are more important. When closing skills are used at the wrong time, in the wrong place, with the wrong person, another brick is added to the wall of resistance. When people sense that they are about to be hit with a hard close, the wall starts to increase in thickness and strength. So we've talked about understanding mistakes and blunders in the world of average persuaders. Now let's look on the flip side. We begin to look inside your audience's mind, and we talk to them. What are some things that they love about persuaders? We did the research at the Persuasion Institute, and we've noticed that there are certain qualities that persuaders have, and many of them are emotion-based. They have made their audience feel good about themselves or comfortable about you, and there was nothing in there about price, quality, or warranties. When you have these traits, they keep the brick wall of resistance from forming. We hear things like, he kept his promises. Promises made during the persuasion process are fulfilled. Persuaders are honest and realistic in what they promise. They don't build false hopes or expectations. Of course, they know you've heard this before. They underpromise and overdeliver, not the other way around. We also hear, she's really dependable. Successful persuaders give their audience the attention they deserve, doing everything in their power to resolve any problem, challenge, or concern. They are reliable. Nothing stops a job from getting done or from getting a callback. We also hear, he's clearly very well trained. Successful persuaders know their product, including its strengths and weaknesses, and how it stacks up against the competition. A great persuader is always an expert on the product, service, or idea he is handling. We hear, she was very sincere, very genuine. Real persuaders don't act like they're just out for a hefty commission. They are sincerely interested in their audience and have their best interest in mind. Also, I consider him a friend. Taking the time to build rapport pays off. Personable, likable, caring, and friendly persuaders make the grade. They know that people buy for people they like. Or we hear, she'd never argue with us. A good persuader is not so bent on making a point that she argues with her prospects. She is not consumed with her own need to be right. She knows she will not persuade by demonstrating that her audience is wrong, misinformed, or educated. Here's another one. He provides solutions at work. Helping an audience visualize their success brings the persuader and audience together to illustrate how the product or service will get them there. How about this? She always takes 100% responsibility. No matter what happens, a great persuader accepts full responsibility for results. When challenges present themselves, she always deals with those challenges rather than making excuses. How about this? I can tell he's really behind the products. Successful persuaders love what they offer. They know they cannot get someone to believe in a product more than they do. Or, she's honest. It is always clear where a great persuader stands. She is always honest with herself and with others. From this position of strength, she is the audience's friend, advisor, and advocate. And finally, he's really entertaining. His visits are always a treat. Winning persuaders are fun and enjoyable to talk to. They help others feel good about themselves and put smiles on their faces. They are full of charisma, love to be around people, and are the ones to bring light to the room. Their presentations are lively, engaging, and informative. So let me tell you another fable about the sun and the wind. The sun and the wind were always arguing about which of them was the strongest. The wind believed that he was stronger because of his destructive power in tornadoes and hurricanes. He wanted the sun to admit he was stronger, but the sun held fast to his own opinion and could not be convinced. One day, the sun decided he wanted the matter settled once and for all, so he invited the wind to compete with him in a contest. The sun chose the contest carefully. He pointed out an old man taking a walk and challenged the wind to use his power to blow off the man's jacket. The wind felt that this would be an easy contest to win and began to blow. To his surprise, each gust of wind only made the man cling more tightly to his jacket. The wind blew harder, and the man held on tighter. The harder the wind blew, the more the man resisted. The powerful blows of the wind even knocked the man down, but he would not let go of his jacket. Finally, the wind gave up and challenged the sun to succeed in getting the man to take off his jacket. The sun smiled and shone radiantly upon the man. The man felt the warmth of the sun, and sweat began to appear on his forehead. The sun continued pouring out warmth and sunshine upon the man, and at last the man took off his jacket. The sun had won the contest. What does this mean? Your goal is to help others want to do what you want them to do and like doing it. So to sum up, imagine what would happen in the world of persuasion if lawsuits were just as prevalent as they were in the medical industries. Doctors are sued left and right for malpractice, for bad judgment, and for the sake of making a quick buck. Can you see a persuader being sued for malpractice? For not providing the right information? For suggesting the wrong product? Or even exhibiting a bad bedside manner? What if all persuaders were held accountable for their advice, their solutions, or their product knowledge? Although they aren't, I think you should hold yourself accountable to such standards. If you want to achieve true greatness, to be the best in your field, and to keep customers for life, then you must maintain the highest standards. So Chinese proverb says, deep doubts, deep wisdom, small doubts, little wisdom. When we take an honest look at our persuasion methods, we often find that what we think we need to work on and what we actually need to work on are two different things. The truth is, even in our areas of strength, there is still always room for improvement. I have never met a top persuasion professional who didn't review or who felt they had every single skill perfectly mastered. Great persuaders are always open to new ideas, and they're always willing to look for ways to improve even the most basic skills. Remember, success starts with learning and mastering the fundamentals. If you want to become a better persuader, first, master the fundamentals. Know them inside and out, and cultivate the ability to execute them flawlessly. Then, as you gain mastery over the basics, you can incrementally add new tools to your toolbox of persuasion. Whatever skill you are focusing on at any particular time, always be a professional and strive to be the best at what you do. Now, let's get into the 10 traits, habits, and characteristics of top persuaders.